Good morning. Welcome to church. My name is Paul Fisher. I have been a member at First Unitarian since February of 2012, and I'm a current board member here at the church. And in the pulpit this morning, we have a guest from First Unitarian of St. Louis. His name is Jeremy Colton, to bring us a wonderful message this morning. Anybody that is, I'd like to invite you to stay afterwards for fellowship and refreshments in the Kate Worker Room behind us. And if you're new to this church or just visiting, we invite you to stay afterwards and talk to one of our members. And, we have a lot of literature out there, and to sign our book if you're ready and willing. And now I invite you to greet your neighbor, especially the ones you don't know yet. If anybody has any announcements for the good of the church, I'd like to invite you to step up to the mic.
I know. I'm Nancy. No boot this morning for a little while. But my announcement is actually we have cake to say bon voyage to our dear Sharon Lee. So afterwards, grab some cake and wish them well. And looks good, too.
Now I'd like to invite you up to the microphone to share any gratitude, joys, or milestones that you'd like to share with the church this morning. If there's no joy, I'd like to invite you to the microphone to share any sorrows or concerns that you bring to the church this morning. No sorrow. That's good. All right. Well, our prelude begins as Ben Heft lights our chalice. Come into the circle of love and justice. Come into the community of mercy, holiness, and health. Come and you shall know peace and joy. Our first hymn is in your order of service. It is, He's Got the Whole World in His Hands. Thank you. right, our responsive reading this morning is number 584, A Network of Mutuality. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny.
Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
There are some things in our social system which all of us ought to be maladjusted.
Hatred and bitterness can never cure the diseases of fear. Only love can do that.
We must evolve for all human conflict, a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation.
The foundation of such a method is love.
Because it is too late, we must narrow the gaping chasm between our proclamations of peace and our lowly deeds which precipitate and perpetuate war.
One day we must come to see that peace is not merely a distant goal which we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal.
We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means.
We shall only bow on the mountainous stairway.
This morning, coming around, if we've been greatly blessed, so please give generously.
Our first reading this morning is from chapter 14 of Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan. The condition of man is a condition of war of everyone against everyone, in which case everyone is governed by his own reason, and there is nothing he can make use of that may not be a help unto him in preserving his life against his enemies. It followeth that in such a condition, every man has a right to everything, even to one another's body. And therefore, as long as this natural right of every man to everything endureth, there can be no security to any man, how strong or wise soever he be, of living out the time which nature ordinarily alloweth men to live. And consequently, it is a precept or general rule of reason that every man ought to endeavor peace as far as he has hope of obtaining it. And when he cannot obtain it, that he may seek and use all helps and advantages of war. The first branch of which rule containeth the first and fundamental law of nature, which is to seek peace and follow it. The second, the sum of the right of nature, which is, by all means we can, to defend ourselves. From this fundamental law of nature, by which men are commanded to endeavor peace, is derived this second law, that a man be willing, when others are so too, as far forth as for peace and defense of himself he shall think it necessary, to lay down this right to all things, and be contented
with so much liberty against other men as he would allow other men against himself. For as long as every man holdeth this right of doing anything he liketh, so long are all men in the condition of war. But if other men will not lay down their right as well as he, then there is no reason for anyone to divest himself of his, for that were to expose himself to prey, which no man is bound to, rather than to dispose himself to peace. This is that law of the gospel: whatsoever you require that others should do to you, that do ye to them.
And I'd like to offer a modern reading. This is from Daniel Dennett's 2000 book, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. Daniel Dennett writes, "Consider the two utterly different meanings of the word materialistic. In its most common everyday sense, it refers to someone who cares only about material possessions, wealth, and its trappings. In a scientific or philosophical sense, it refers to a theory that aspires to explain all the phenomena without recourse to anything immaterial, like a Cartesian soul or ectoplasm or God. The standard negation of materialistic in the scientific sense is dualistic, which maintains that there are two entirely different kinds of substance, matter and whatever minds are supposedly made of. The apparent bridge tying the two meanings together is obvious enough. If you don't think you have an immortal soul, then you don't believe you'll get your reward in heaven, so you may as well go for whatever you can get in this material world. If asked people what term was the negation of materialistic in the everyday sense, they might very well settle on spiritual. In the course of my research on this book, I found one opinion expressed in slightly different ways by people across the spectrum of religious views. Man has a, quote, deep need for, quote, spirituality, a need that is fulfilled for some by traditional organized religion, for others by New Age cults or movement or hobbies, and for still others by the intense pursuit of art or music, pottery or environmental activism, or football. What fascinates me about this delightfully versatile craving for, quote, spirituality, is that people think they know what they're talking about, even though, or because, perhaps because, nobody bothers to explain just what they mean. It is supposed to be obvious, I guess, but really it isn't. When I've asked people to explain themselves, they typically beg off along the lines of Louis Armstrong's oft-quoted reply when asked what jazz was: if you gotta ask, you ain't ever gonna get to know. This will not do. To see for yourself just how hard it is to see what spirituality is, take a stab at improving on this parody, boiled down from many frustrating encounters. Spirituality is, you know, like, it's like paying attention to your soul or having deep thoughts that really move you, and not just thinking about who's got nicer clothes and whether to buy a new car and what's for dinner and stuff like that. Spirituality is really caring and not being just, you know, materialistic. Along with this common and unreflective view of spirituality goes a stereotype of the atheist. Atheists lack, quote, values. They, we, are careless, self-centered, shallow, overconfident. They think they know it all, and yet they completely miss out on the spirit. Paran, you can't really be a good person unless you have a spiritual life. Now, let me try to put better words in their mouths. What these people have realized is one of the best secrets of life: let yourself go. If you can approach the world's complexities, both its glories and its horrors, with an attitude of humble curiosity, acknowledge that however deeply you have seen, you have only just scratched the surface. you will find worlds within worlds, beauties you could not heretofore imagine, and your own mundane preoccupations will shrink to proper size, not all that important in the greater scheme of things. Keep that awestruck vision of the world ready to hand when dealing with the demands of daily living is no easy exercise, but it is definitely worth the effort. For if you can stay centered and engaged, you will find the hard choices easier, the right words will come to you when you need them, and you will indeed be a better person. That, I propose, is the secret to spirituality, and it has nothing at all to do with believing in an immortal soul or anything supernatural. That's the other one. Okay, that's the prayer and meditation is next. Huh? I don't have a prayer, so I could lead a meditation. I didn't prepare. Okay. Well, let's all close our eyes and relax. Think about your own breathing. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, and breathe out. And take some time to think about the love that's in this place, or anything else you choose to think about. Let go or hold on to as much or as little as you choose. And let's all just be quiet together for a few minutes. And as you feel comfortable, if everyone would please just gradually bring yourself back and open your eyes if you like, or not. And the next thing we'd like to do is sing hymn number 1051 from the Teal Hymnal. Let me just say a word about that. This has a number of repeats in it, and it gets a little bit complicated. So what Rachel and I have decided to do is to do the first repeat. So there's one repeat at the very beginning. So we're going to do the one repeat, and then we're just going to sing the rest of the hymn all the way through and ignore the other repeats. So that's how we're going to do it. 1051, rise as you choose or feel comfortable or in spirit. So today I'd like to discuss the source of morality and to share a tool that I use to help sort right from wrong. According to renowned scientist Stephen Jay Gould, in science, fact can only mean, quote, confirmed to such a degree that it would be perverse to withhold provisional consent. The evidence that all humans interact within moral systems, in my opinion, meets this standard. In today's readings, Hobbes and Dennett both offer commentary on the possible source of our human morality. In Hobbes' view, there is no innate reason or even justification for treating our fellows kindly. He builds an argument that it is in our own interest to have a totalitarian ruler, because otherwise we will all suffer at one another's hands. It is an intriguing argument, but I don't think it holds up to modern evidence of moral systems in all places and at all times. Dennett argues against dualism, wherein our better nature comes from an immortal soul or some other external source. If one doesn't need a soul to be fully human in the spiritual sense, then it follows that our morality comes from no external source either. I think that Dennett would agree with me that morality is, at least primarily, an evolved attribute of our species. Of course, many contemporary thinkers, along with most people through history, simply assume that right and wrong come from God, and the trick is to figure out what he wants. I would like to put the explicit source of morality, be it biology, deity, or proclaimed regent, to one side and start with the question that matters most to me. What is morality for? I call this approach the hepatic theory of morality. Slightly tongue-in-cheek. After all, if we want to truly understand our livers, the fact that they can raise our serum glucose and remove poison from our blood are not terribly meaningful if it is supposed to be moving blood through our circulatory system. And how can one answer, is adding sugar to my bloodstream good or bad, without asking to what end? Perhaps your liver is an invasive parasite flooding your system with sugar to your detriment for some nefarious purpose of its own. So I assert that in order to have any hope of understanding our moral system, we need to ask, what is it for? Notice that it doesn't matter much if it came from God, or it was evolved, or it was imposed with our consent by a king. Creationists and biologists both agree that the liver has real functions, and we determine if it is working correctly according to whether those functions are being carried out the way they should be. A common misperception about natural selection is that because individuals or perhaps genes are selected, that is, survive, according to Huxley's survival of the fittest, evolution of cooperation is ruled out. Richard Dawkins demonstrates why this is not true with the analogy of the rowing team. If we are selecting for teams that reach the finish line first, individuals that can pull hard on the oars will be expected to do well. However, if the strongest rower cannot stay in sync with the other rowers, that rower's boat will lose, and said rower will have been selected out of the next stage of the competition. My point is, being able to cooperate is critically important to genes and to organs and to entire human beings. Those of us who work best with other human beings do best, even in the strictly biological sense, including at the level of individual. So there you have it, friends. The purpose of morality is to cause us to do things that help us get along with other human beings. Since I am firmly convinced that this statement is true, I approach moral conundrums by asking, will doing or not doing this action help, hinder, or be neutral as far as people getting along with other people? Sometimes the answers align quite nicely with traditional morality, other times, not so much. Let me give a simple example and then one that's more ambiguous. Is it wrong to kill someone to take their stuff? The Unitarian Universalist answer is that it is wrong because the victim's inherent worth as a human being is violated. In another moral system, more information might be needed. Is the victim running off with a serum that can save 100 lives? What if she owns it but is determined to let those people die anyway? A nihilist might argue that none of it makes any difference since we're all going to die anyway. Now ask instead whether one person killing another increases or decreases cooperation. Well, the victim won't be cooperating with anyone, so that's one strike against. What about the other people the killer interacts with? Even if the murder seems perfectly justified by some other standard, they will never fully trust that person again. Strike two. And even the killer himself will become, and not herself, because they're mostly men, will become withdrawn and less inclined to interact with others, lest he be found out or judged. The hepatic theory draws a clear line from murder to wrong. Is it wrong to abort a viable human fetus? Many people who engage in this moral debate take absolute positions. The well-known extreme positions are, it's growing in my body, it's my decision, and the law has no right to say otherwise, and it's a human being and may not be harmed no matter what. I think the hepatic theory gives a more nuanced answer, and I don't mean to imply that there are not nuanced answers besides mine. Remember, I'm offering a tool, not an answer, because I'm not smart enough to have all the answers. Here's how I sum up the impact on cooperation. First of all, the potential person. I do not think the situation is analogous to the murder victim. In biology, apoptosis, programmed cell death, is a common cooperative element necessary to everyone's growth and development. When hospital corpsman third class Edward Clyde Benfold sacrificed his own life by carrying live hand grenades away from other soldiers, it was an ultimate act of cooperation. So I will put the object of the action aside for this consideration. Next, what about the law that tells the woman what she has to do with her own body? Making a law telling someone what to do with her own body is definitely anti-cooperation and therefore, from my point of view, morally wrong. I think that the people represented by Johnny Take Away Their Rights lawmaker truly and sincerely find abortion abhorrent. Although I don't think the yuck factor is enough to base a decision on, I also think it's likely that the 250,000 years of evolution behind that reaction are smarter than I am, and therefore it should be taken into consideration. More to the point here is that doing something that millions of well-meaning people find abhorrent is anti-cooperation. My conclusion, based on my use of the purpose tool, is that the deliberate abortion of a potential human being is morally wrong in this society, in this time, in the sense that it is something better not done when there is an alternative. Since both sides of this argument are both right and wrong, my tool doesn't give a clear answer. It does, however, show me that I am comparing one wrong against another rather than right to wrong. I have found that enough to make practical decisions that I have to make as citizen and sire. Again, I mean to demonstrate how the tool is used, and you may reach quite different conclusions. My hope is not that you will come to agree with me, and it has no practical effect, since I clearly have no right to decide for someone else, but that you will add this tool as a way to help clarify moral questions for yourself. And now, if you would rise and body or spirit, or as you feel, and turn to hymn 186 in the Gray Hymnal, Grieve Not Your Heart. Take our leave. Before we gather here again, may each of us bring happiness into another's life. May we each be surprised by the gifts that surround us. May each of us be enlivened by constant curiosity, and may we remain together in spirit till the hour we meet again. Thank you.